even when it's right in front of us. Camille shifted the doll in her arms, stared into its eyes. You and Greta did such a great job on her. At the mention of her name, Rory's mind ignited with images of Greta as she babbled with dementia each time Rory walked into her room, confused and overwhelmed by Rory's presence. I tried to save you. There was too much blood. Rory remembered the fear in Greta's eyes each time she visited. The distress that lasted a few desperate seconds until Greta snapped back from the tortured memories of her past. I wish I could have saved you as easily as Rory and I saved the dolls. The world began to spin as Rory remembered the mysterious pull that had taken hold of her as a 10-year-old girl, the one that ushered her to the prairie behind the farmhouse. Everything blurred around her as she thought of the roses heaped in a pile on the ground, of their sweet scent that filled her body when she placed them to her nose, of the peace that came to her. As quickly as the spinning started, the world stopped. Rory found herself alone. Camille Bird was gone. In her place on the grassy knoll was a bundle of roses and the Kestner doll, restored to perfection. Greta's voice echoed in her ears. I tried to save you. There was too much blood. There's too much blood. We have to go to the hospital. He's coming. You told me he'll come for you. Then Camille Bird's voice. The truth is easy to miss, even when it's right in front of us. As Rory stood in the grassy knoll of Grant Park, it all made sense. The connection she felt to Angela Mitchell and all the similarities that linked them. Her father's appeal letters that screamed to Rory an ulterior motive about never wanting Thomas Mitchell out of jail. Greta's connection to Angela, her career as a midwife. The adoption to Frank and Marla Moore. Her father's stress during the final year of his life, as he could no longer stop Thomas Mitchell's release from jail. And something else that tugged at her. It was so close to surfacing that the harder she reached into the far recesses of her mind to retrieve it, the more she stirred in bed. Rory moaned now as she tried to pull herself from sleep. As Rory tried to run, she heard Camille Bird's voice. When she turned, the girl was back on the grass, standing with the blanket cloaked over her shoulders. The yellow halogen painted Camille's shadow on the wall behind her, and the image triggered Rory's mind. She understood what had been bothering her, and she knew it was Camille who had helped her epiphany. Thank you for restoring my doll. It means everything to my father. When Rory looked, the Kestner was flawless as it rested in Camille's arms. The girl waved again, and then Rory ran and ran. Chapter 38, Chicago, November 5th, 2019. She woke with a jolt, kicking herself awake. The sheets were tangled around her legs, and it took her a moment to free them. Covered in sweat, she felt her heart thundering as she remembered her dream. When she replayed the image of Camille Bird's shadow cast on the brick wall, Rory jumped from bed. She stepped into a pair of jeans, pulled on a t-shirt, and sunk her feet into her combat boots. She draped her beanie hat over her head as she crashed through the front door and climbed into her car. At just past midnight, there was no traffic, and she reached the nursing home in 15 minutes. She sped into the turnabout, where the ambulance and fire truck had been parked the day before, left her car running and the driver's side door open as she ran into the building. Rory had made many midnight trips to the nursing home over the years and knew the place would be asleep. There was a young man tending the front desk when Rory rattled into the lobby in her combat boots. Hi, the man whispered in a voice meant to display the serenity of the place at such an hour. Are you here to see a resident? I need to see the visitor log from yesterday. Do you need to sign in? No, I just need to look through the log from yesterday. Are you looking for a specific resident? Rory took a breath. She could play this one of two ways. Force the issue by threatening to have Ron Davidson of the CPD down here in a matter of minutes to find the log for her, or play the sympathy card. She chose the latter. My aunt passed yesterday. Her dear friend came to see her just before she died, and I've forgotten her name. I'm sure she signed in, and I was hoping to recognize her name. Oh, the young man was immediately defenseless. Of course. He opened a drawer behind the desk and pulled out a thick three-ring binder. He placed it on the counter, spun it so that it was upright for Rory, and opened the cover. Bound neatly into the rings were the year of visitor log sign-in sheets. Yesterday's was on top. Rory placed her finger on the first line of the page and quickly skimmed down the names until she saw it. Her fierce mind flashed with images of Thomas Mitchell's penmanship from reading the letters he had written to her father. The thief's writing had been meticulous, all caps and in perfect rows, despite the lineless paper on which it was printed. Rory remembered the unique way in which he wrote his A's as inverted V's. The character had jumped from the page in every word where it was present. The unusual symbol filled her vision now as she remembered the font. The nursing home began to spin, just like in her dream. She remembered Camille Bird's image from her dream, when the girl stood and the halogen light painted her shadow on the brick wall. It reminded Rory of the night she stood in the alley behind Angela Mitchell's house, her legs forming the same inverted V. Rory remembered, too, the eerie sensation that had come over her that night. She had felt it again yesterday when she signed the visitor log, a premonition she had been unable to place. It had screamed for her attention just before the nurse appeared out of the corner of her eye, hurrying toward her to break the news about Greta. Now, measured and with a gentle push from Camille Bird, Rory was able to comprehend it. Thomas Mitchell's penmanship was present on the page in front of her, the same inverted V's. The person who had come to see the resident in room 121 had written Greta's name in perfect block, all caps letters. Margaret Schreiber. Chapter 39. Starved Rock, Illinois, November 5th, 2019. It was approaching 2 o'clock a.m. when Rory took the highway exit. I-80 had been empty but for the rare set of isolated headlights, and now she found herself truly alone as she took the sleepy country roads that led toward Starved Rock State Park and the cabin that waited in the woods. She'd driven the route twice before, and this third outing came from memory. She didn't hesitate at the forks, didn't contemplate the T's. She knew the way. The route had burned itself into her memory the way everything else did, the same way all the details of her life were stored and categorized. Rory wasn't always aware of the things her mind noticed or picked up on, and could not readily comprehend the enormous volume of material her memory logged. But since her dream, since finding Camille Bird's spirit nestled in the grassy knoll in Grant Park, all the cryptic elements of her childhood and the farmhouse, of Aunt Greta and her parents, of her visits to the nursing home and the dolls she restored, of Greta's seemingly random mutterings, of the mysterious pull that had once drawn her to the back property of the farmhouse as a young child, of the instant attraction she felt toward Angela Mitchell, and of the nearly identical symptoms they shared of social anxiety and obsessive compulsion, all came to her with vivid clarity. She knew what it all meant. She had finally grasped that elusive element of her existence that had been out of reach for so long, and it had taken nothing more than a push from the spirit of a dead girl who waited for her help. The truth is easy to miss, even when it's right in front of us. Rory's epiphany had brought her to this place tonight. She was at the precipice of darkness, and her soul felt tainted by it. She was unsure if it was possible to correct this mutation at the core of her existence, but anger drove her to try. She made the final turn of her journey. Her headlamps were the only source of light in the otherwise black night. Until she turned them off. Then only the moon was present, and it offered little guidance. She pulled her car to the side of the road, crunched over the gravel, and turned off the engine. 200 yards ahead was the canopied driveway that led to Thomas Mitchell's cabin. She picked up her phone for the 100th time, stared at the lit display. She'd had Lane's number plugged in and ready to connect multiple times throughout the drive to Starved Rock, but had stopped herself from calling. The same for Ron Davidson's number, which she had also pulled up during the hour drive. To call either of the men in her life would have prevented her from doing what she was about to do. Rory decided that only one man would be part of her life tonight. The one who had played a silent and unknown role in her existence. The man who had perhaps formed her character. The one who had taken from her more than she could reclaim tonight. As she climbed from her car and eased the door closed, she wondered if extinguishing the source of a fire could stifle the flames that blazed in adjacent structures. The silence of the night overwhelmed her ability to answer her own question as she headed toward the canopied drive. Halfway between her parked car and the cabin's driveway, Rory found a path that led into the forest. She clicked to life the flashlight on her cell phone and followed the trail. 200 yards later, she heard the gentle gurgling of water and knew the river was up ahead. When she came to the clearing, the river bled to either side and reflected the moon off its surface like a mystical snake slithering through the night. She followed the riverbank for another 200 yards until she found the dock she had seen during her first visit to the cabin with the parole officer Ezra Parker and the social worker Naomi Brown. There was a long stretch of neglected stairs that led from the water's edge up the steep embankment. She took them cautiously, one at a time, as her sternum began to throb and her head became flush with blood. At the top of the stairs, she saw the cabin sitting in the middle of 5 acres. The square clearing was surrounded by forest. As she slowly set off for the structure, the moon cast a faint shadow next to her. It was her only companion. Chapter 40. Starved Rock, Illinois, November 5th, 2019. She approached from the rear. The windows of the cabin were dark, the sort of darkness that made Rory think she was looking into a black hole. Rory slowly navigated her way from the edge of the forest and across the long stretch of grass behind the cabin. She crept without the aid of her flashlight. The grass beneath her boots felt level and her steps were unchallenged. But as she came to within 50 yards of the cabin, she took a step but found no earth beneath her. She stumbled forward, falling a full 3 feet until her feet finally hit the ground. By then it was too late to right herself. She crashed face first onto the ground, the damp odor of soil heavy in her nostrils. She lay still for a moment, attempting to gain her bearings. She felt for her phone, which was thrown from her hand on impact. When she found it, she turned on the flashlight. As she looked around, it was clear that she was in a freshly dug hole. Above her, a mound of dirt sat in the dark. Climbing to her knees, Rory slowly stood from the pit, the top of which was up to her waist. Her breathing was labored when she looked back to the cabin. It remained dark and quiet. She climbed from the hole, shut off her cell phone, and started off again toward the cabin. When she came to the gravel drive that encircled the cottage, she remembered bending her car around its curves 2 mornings before. She followed it again now to the front of the cabin, and reached into the pocket of her coat to feel for the only weapon she thought to bring, the Swiss Army knife Kip had given her. She peeled open the blade as she crossed the gravel, her combat boots crunching over the rocks and the red clay that covered the ground. Her first stride onto the stairs caused the porch to creak under her weight. In the dead of night, it may have been a cannon shot. After a moment of pause, Rory continued to the next step and then the next, until she was standing at the front door of the cabin. To pause now would be to lose her nerve. She grasped the handle and twisted. The door opened without protest, the hinges squeaking softly as the handle floated from her grip. She waited 30 seconds, felt a tremor rattling her fingers. Darkness welcomed her as she stepped inside. Her mind pulled up the blueprint of the floor plan from her only other time in the cabin, back when she came here with the social worker and parole officer. Despite the darkness, she knew there were 3 rooms on the first floor, front room, kitchen, and a porch at the back of the house. The stairs to the left of the front door led to 2 bedrooms and a hall bath. He would be upstairs. He would be sleeping, just like Greta had likely been when he entered her room. She started up the stairs, the blade vibrating in her grip. The bedrooms were empty. The beds were bare, absent of sheets or blankets. Rory descended the stairs, clicked on her phone's flashlight, and splayed it across the front room. On the coffee table were papers scattered in a cluttered mess. She lifted one of the pages and saw his meticulous block penmanship, chronicling his years-long search for his wife. An eerie stimulus simmered just below her sternum. Unable to help herself, Rory sat on the couch, placed the Swiss Army knife on the table, and flipped through the pages. It would have been easy for her to become lost in the words, to surrender to the call to reconstruct his path over the years and see how far his research had taken him. And she might have succumbed to this temptation had she not come across the handwritten map. Written in his distinct block lettering, the inverted V's jumped out at her everywhere they appeared. She tried to understand what she was reading. It looked to be a plat of survey for the cabin and the land on which it sat, architectural renderings of the property and its boundaries. On the formal diagram, rectangular boxes had been drawn by hand. They were organized in a grid formation and covered the open area behind the cabin. In each of the boxes, a name was written. Rory immediately recognized the names as the women who had gone missing in 1979. She dropped the survey to the ground when she realized she was holding a map of a makeshift graveyard, and that she had likely just pulled herself from a freshly dug grave. Chapter 41. Starved Rock, Illinois, November 5th. 2019. She stood in the front room of the cabin, the plat of survey and the graveyard map at her feet, and her body temperature quickly on the rise. She felt the perspiration on the back of her neck and recognized her inability to inhale. A similar episode had gripped her a few nights before, when she struggled to piece together her discoveries about Greta and Angela. And now, here again, she felt the impending doom of a panic attack. Rory ripped the beanie hat off her head and fumbled with the buttons of her jacket. As her pulse raced at an unhealthy clip, she felt cool air on her throat when she unclasped the top of her coat. It provided a moment of clarity and an overwhelming urge to get out of the cabin. Her lungs ached badly enough that she finally sucked for air. With her cell phone flashlight still shining, Rory grabbed the Swiss Army knife from the table, hurried across the front room and through the kitchen. She pushed open the door that led to the porch with a plan to cut across the back of the property, find the stairs to the river, and race to her car. But when she stepped onto the porch, all thoughts of leaving this place evaporated. A woman sat slumped in a chair, a nylon noose around her neck and her hands bound behind her back. The subtle tremor that had vibrated Rory's fingers now rippled through her entire body as she walked closer and realized she was looking at Catherine Blackwell. The noose around her neck was attached to a rope that snaked upward to a large wooden contraption bolted to the porch ceiling. Rory ran her cell phone light over it. The rope slithered around three pulleys, up, down, before the other end fell to the floor a few feet away from Catherine. The apparatus took on the shape of an M, and Rory instantly remembered it from Angela's drawings. She had discovered a similar tool in her husband's warehouse. Rory pulled the beam of her light down from the ceiling and hurried to Catherine's side. "Catherine, can you hear me?" As soon as she spoke the words, Rory knew they were worthless. The woman's eyes stayed closed. Her body was cold. Rory swiped the face of her phone. It took three attempts, her shaking fingers unable to activate the slider. When she finally had the phone open, she hesitated for an instant, contemplating whether to call Ron Davidson or dial 911. During her indecision, she saw the light out in the distance. Through the screen of the porch out across the back of the property, she spotted a wobbling light. The long beam of the flashlight cut through the darkness and bounced in a rhythmic cadence as the person who carried it made his way toward the cabin. Remembering her initial view of the cabin from when she had crested the stairs from the riverbank a few minutes earlier, Rory realized the glow of her phone would stand out in the darkness. She quickly doused the light by covering her phone with her hand and pressing it to her chest. Still crouching next to Catherine's body, she turned her flashlight off and dropped the phone in her pocket. Then she turned and ran back through the door and into the kitchen. As she quietly closed the door to the porch, she saw the bouncing flashlight approaching. The distance had been cut in half. He was perhaps 30 seconds from reaching the cabin. In the darkness, Rory fumbled around the kitchen for somewhere to hide. She realized that she had stopped breathing again and was momentarily distressed at the idea of having to remember to inhale. On the wall adjacent to the porch, she felt the handle of the pantry door. She opened it and slipped inside just as she heard the outside door to the porch squeak open.
"Have you got one more round in you? I'm sure you do."
Rory trembled in the pantry as she heard Thomas Mitchell's voice. Chapter 42, Starved Rock, Illinois, November 5th, 2019. Rory worked to control her breathing as she stood in the pantry, the door of which she had pulled to her nose like the lid of a casket. Mold and dust filled her nostrils and tears blurred her vision. A sliver of visibility was available between the door and the frame. Her sternum ached, and her ears thundered with the rush of circulation as she watched Thomas Mitchell prepare a meal in the kitchen. He stood just 5 or 6 feet from her as he mixed food in a metal bowl and then ate while he stood, clinically separated from the enjoyment of taste, interested only in the need for sustenance. He had turned on the lights when he entered the cabin, giving Rory a clear view of the kitchen and porch. As she moved her gaze around, she noticed the red footprints she had tracked across the floor. She looked to the area immediately in front of the pantry and saw the hurried scuff marks she created when she had slid into her hiding spot. Her panic rose, and she concentrated on reviving her lungs and leveling off her breathing. It sounded to her as if she took each breath through a bullhorn, and that any second Thomas would walk to the pantry, open the door, and discover his prize. She was prepared to scratch and claw, to gouge and punch. She wouldn't hesitate to bite any piece of anatomy that came close to her if she had to. The only thing she wouldn't do was die at this man's hand. Too many other women had. It was why Rory was staring at him now when she should have been racing down the canopied drive and out to her car. It had taken her this long to realize it.
As usual, her conscious mind took a moment to catch up to the small triggers of her subconscious. But she knew now why she hadn't run out the front door when she had the chance, or why she had turned her phone off rather than dial 911. The same way Camille Bird's spirit had spoken to her a few hours before, there were others who needed Rory's help. Others who waited for peace and closure. They were buried behind this cabin, where they had lain in turmoil for 40 years. Rory could no more turn her back to those women now than she could to Camille Bird. Rory didn't need Lane or Ron or anyone else to help the women who waited for her. The women needed Rory, and Rory needed to answer their calls for help. Just as these thoughts materialized in her mind, Thomas placed the metal bowl from which he had been eating onto the kitchen counter and walked toward her. Rory retreated an inch or two, as far as she could in the cramped space, receding farther into the darkness of the pantry. Her lungs became so difficult to fill, she was certain her efforts had betrayed her hiding spot. She closed her eyes, waiting for the sliver of light that crept into the pantry to explode as Thomas opened the door. The brightness would be her prompt to attack, to fight like hell, for herself, for Catherine, for the lost souls behind the cabin. Her muscles tensed as she readied to pounce. But instead, music drowned out her heaving breaths. Her eyes blinked open, and she set her gaze back to the crevice between the door and the frame. She scanned the kitchen, but he was gone. She heard Mozart's Requiem fill the cabin, soft at first, and then louder, and louder and louder. Finally, he appeared. He walked past the pantry and out to the porch. Chapter 43. Starved Rock, Illinois, November 5th, 2019. The music was deafening in the cabin, but here on the porch it was just right. He hoped it was loud enough to stir her, to bring her back. He longed for the lyrical chorus of Mozart's Requiem to wake her and tell her what was to come. She had barely survived the last round, and he wasn't sure she was still alive. He refused to check now. He didn't want to know if she was gone. He'd missed the rush more than he imagined and longed for it once more. His two leads had run sour. One was too old to offer much, even if he believed she knew the truth. He hadn't the time to elicit it from her. He thought he'd have more luck with the one in front of him, but she proved to be just as useless to his search for Angela. And when he didn't know where to go next, he succumbed to his long-subdued urging for the rush. Now, as the ode to lost souls spilled from the cabin and filled his ears, Thomas stepped up onto the stool 6 feet from Catherine Blackwell. He slipped the nylon noose around his neck, instantaneously feeling the surge of endorphins fill his body. Tightening the strap, he slowly eased himself off the stool and watched as she levitated from the chair. It was a glorious sight. Coupled with both the charm of the music and the rush that surged through his body, Thomas Mitchell slipped off to euphoria. He closed his eyes for a moment. Despite being out of practice, he reminded himself of the dangers of overindulgence. The rush was a cryptic practice. It provided the closest thing this world offered to bliss, dangled it on a stick in front of him, and begged him to come for it. But Thomas knew the Grim Reaper held that stick, and to abuse the rush or to take too much of it would spell the end. Perhaps that was the lure. Ecstasy and mortality divided by such a fine line. He was there now, euphoric as his body shook with the rush. He slivered his eyes open to take in the sight of the woman floating in front of him. He witnessed her magically hanging in the air. It was magnificent and perfect. Until it wasn't.
until a flash of something appeared in his peripheral vision. It startled him. He opened his eyes fully, grasping for the noose around his neck and searching with his foot for the stool. Chapter 44. Starved Rock, Illinois, November 5th, 2019. Rory watched from the pantry as Thomas pulled a stool to the center of the porch. He fidgeted with the noose overhead. Finally, he mounted the stool, hooked the nylon around his neck, and slowly lowered himself off the stool while Catherine simultaneously rose into the air across from him, like a magician levitating his subject. The sight stole what little breath Rory had left. Through the crack in the pantry door, Rory witnessed the strange scene play out before her. She had reconstructed cases that dealt with the despicable practice of autoerotic asphyxiation, and had read articles about the perverted individuals who reached sexual gratification from its practice. But the scene unfolding in front of her was something entirely different. It was not sexual in nature, but perverted in another, more disturbing way. The high Thomas Mitchell was reaching came not from any perverse use of sex, but rather from the pleasure of watching another die. Rory saw Catherine's legs dangle limply as she rose, the weight of Thomas's body on the other side of the pulley system dragging her upward. Rory remembered the dual pulley system Angela had drawn in her notes, chronicling what she had discovered in Thomas's warehouse. He had recreated that system here in his cabin, and across from him now was his wife's only friend. Someone who he surely believed had helped Angela disappear 40 years earlier. How terribly wrong he had it, Rory thought. As he lowered himself in a slow, guided movement, he kept one foot on the stool as a failsafe, placing his weight back onto its surface when the tension became too great and he neared unconsciousness. When he put his weight back on the stool, he rose higher and allowed Catherine to sink back to the ground. Rory watched the eerie seesawing while the classical music blared through the cabin. When she saw Thomas take his weight off the stool again and sink downward, coming to a rest 12 inches from the cabin floor, with the noose tight around his neck and his face boiling to a deep crimson, Rory felt the pull in her chest. It was as powerful as when she was a child at Greta's farmhouse. She quickly pushed open the pantry door, the sounds of her movements camouflaged by Mozart. She reached into the pocket of her coat and retrieved the Dark Lord Swiss Army knife. Unfolding the device, the blade caught the light from the porch. Her movements as she charged through the porch door startled Thomas, who worked frantically to gain leverage on the stool under him. His blood-red face took on another shade, deeper now, purple. He worked to gain footing on the stool, his legs flailing until his right foot touched the top surface. If given another few seconds, he would have had the stool underneath him and the pressure relieved from his neck. Rory made sure to take those seconds from him. She walked slowly over to him, their eyes meeting. Hers calm and calculating, his bulging and panicked. For once, Rory had no inclination to avoid eye contact. She thought of Aunt Greta alone in her room the night Thomas had found her. She thought of the women buried beneath the ground behind the cabin. She thought of Catherine. She thought of Angela. Rory folded the Swiss Army knife closed. She wouldn't need it after all. Just as Thomas placed his foot on the stool, Rory kicked it out from under him. His body dropped down a few inches, recoiling with the jolt. She watched as he reached for his neck, trying unsuccessfully to pry his fingers between the noose and his skin. As he thrashed about, Rory took a good long moment to stare at him before whispering in his ear. His bulging eyes appeared to widen. Then she turned to tend to Catherine. She couldn't leave her strung up like cattle. It took a few minutes before Rory had her body lying peacefully on the ground of the porch. Then, with Thomas still meekly thrashing, she walked into the kitchen and lifted the phone from the cradle. The card had been stuck into the crevice between the phone jack and the wall. Rory dialed the number, waited for a voice to answer, and then laid the phone on the kitchen table. When Rory finally walked from the cabin, she left the front door open. She could still faintly hear Mozart's Requiem when she reached her car. Chapter 45. Chicago, November 5th, 2019. It was 6 in the morning when Rory pulled to the curb outside her house. She hurried barefoot up the steps and fumbled with the lock. Inside, she went straight to the front room, gathered newspapers from the bin next to the hearth, and placed them under the logs in the fireplace. She lit a match and touched the flame to the paper, then carefully kindled the fire until it was blazing. More logs went on top, stacked in a precise teepee to allow maximum heat. Then she undressed and threw her clothes into the fire. First her jeans and t-shirt, next her coat and beanie hat. She waited a moment for the flames to take the fabric. The fire grew strong as it absorbed the clothing. When they were gone, floating up the chimney in small remnants of ash, Rory grabbed her Madden Girl Elwazé combat boots. They were covered in the red clay from her trek through the forest and to the Starved Rock cabin. She placed them in the fire. Standing in her underwear, she watched the boots begin to melt before she walked upstairs and climbed into bed. Lane Phillips keyed the front door and walked into Rory's house. It was just before noon and she hadn't answered her phone. He'd called several times. He noticed the glowing logs of a dying fire in the front room.
"Rory?"
he called. No answer. He checked the study. Empty. The den next, also empty, besides the dolls that lined the shelves. He walked upstairs and found her asleep. Rory Moore would never be considered a morning person, but sleeping until noon was not common either. Lane walked over to the bed to check on her. The covers rose and fell with her rhythmic breathing, and Lane couldn't remember the last time he'd seen Rory sleep so soundly. He noticed the corner of papers poking from under the blanket. He pulled the comforter to the side to find a tattered copy of his thesis. The corners were turned up from frequent readings, the pages crumpled. Lane flipped through the document and saw Rory's notes in the margin of many pages. Toward the end, he found a dog-eared page in the section analyzing why killers kill, and a psychological mechanism that bring an individual to the precipice of deciding to take another's life. In the middle of the page, a passage was highlighted. He read the yellow glowing sentence. "Some choose darkness, others are chosen by it." The page was damp, with circular stains as if someone had dribbled water onto the paper.
Water? Lane thought. Or tears?
The doorbell rang, and Lane looked up from his thesis. Rory didn't stir. The bell rang again. He placed the document on the nightstand and headed down the stairs. He opened the front door to find Ron Davidson standing on the front porch. Chapter 46. Chicago, November 5th, 2019.
Rory?
Her eyelids fluttered. She heard her name again.
Rory.
When she opened her eyes, she saw Lane standing over the bed. He touched her cheek.
"Hey, you feeling okay?"
"Yeah," Rory said, sitting up. "I'm fine." Her mind ignited with quick snippets of her time at the Starved Rock cabin, of Catherine Blackwell hovering off the ground, of Thomas Mitchell in his bizarre state of ecstasy, of her hiding spot in the pantry, and the thin slice of light between the door and the frame, of the classical music. It still rang in her ears. What time is it?
Noon,
Lane said.
Did you hear me about Ron?
No. What about him?
He's here, downstairs. Said he needs to talk with you. Something urgent.
Rory blinked a few times. She saw her copy of Lane's thesis resting on the nightstand. She had been reading it earlier, before sleep took her to a deep, dreamless rest. Rory ran a hand through her hair as she nodded. Tell him I need a minute. The three of them sat in the front room 15 minutes later.
I got a call early this morning from the LaSalle County Sheriff's Office, Ron said.
He was sitting on the couch across from the fireplace, Rory and Lane on adjacent chairs next to him. The fireplace was to Rory's left, Lane's right, and directly in front of the head of Chicago Homicide. If Rory could have chosen, she'd have ushered Ron into the kitchen for this meeting. Instead, when she finally walked down the stairs, he and Lane were sitting in the front room. LaSalle County? Rory asked.
Starved Rock, Ron said. We're still piecing together the details, but it looks like Thomas Mitchell killed himself.
Rory kept her face stoic. It was how she would typically react to this news, and she wanted to look typical today. How? She asked.
Looks like he hanged himself. The details are still coming in. I only talked for a few minutes with the detective in charge. There was another body at the cabin, a woman. It sounded like he tortured her in some way. The county guys are still putting the scene together.
How'd they find him?
He called his parole officer early this morning, about 3 o'clock. Left the phone on the table while he hanged himself. Least that's what they think. The forensics crew is still putting the scene together. Because he was your client, I thought I'd stop by to let you know. I'm getting ready to head out there now.
Rory nodded. Thanks. She looked at Lane, then back to the detective. Sorry I seem off. I'm trying to process everything. Mostly, Rory was worried that she'd left her fingerprints on the phone or somewhere else in the cabin. Or that she hadn't managed to sweep away the red imprints of her combat boots on the way out.
Well, there's more to process, Ron said.
Yeah? What else could there be?
The state guys found a plat of survey at the cabin that looks like a map of the burial grounds for several women who went missing in 1979. All the women who were suspected to have been abducted by Thomas Mitchell.
Sweet Jesus, Lane said.
Sounds like he abducted them from Chicago, killed them, and then buried them behind his uncle's cabin. When the uncle died, he willed the place to his nephew. Son of a bitch probably knew what Thomas was doing all along.
Rory shook her head. I don't know what to say.
My guys will be part of the investigation since the victims were from Chicago. Cook County Sheriff's Office as well.
Makes sense, Rory said.
Say, Gray, when were you last out at Starved Rock?
Rory looked at Ron. You know, the other morning, when Lane and I dropped him off.
Doc?
Ron asked.
That the last time you were there?
Yeah,
Lane said.
Why? What's up? Just crossing my T's. The LaSalle County guys are bound to ask, just giving you two a heads up. Since you were at the cabin, they'll probably ask to talk with you.
Sure,
Lane said. Rory nodded. Of course. A glowing log popped in the fireplace, a loud crack that caught everyone's attention. Rory looked for the first time at the spot where she had burned her clothing a few hours earlier. A muscle in her neck twitched when she saw the remnants of one of her combat boots sitting on top of the ashes. It was the front half, toe and sole, about 4 inches of leather and rubber that the fire had failed to swallow. The boot stuck out from a glowing log as obvious as dead fish floating in an aquarium. It was covered in the red dust from the clay terrain of the starved rock cabin. She looked at the area in front of the hearth and noticed a faint patch of blood-red dust from where she had placed her boots while she waited for her clothes to burn. In the split second after the log crackled, and during the time it took Rory to recognize her errors, she saw Lane stand from his chair and grab the poker.
"Whatever you need from us,"
Lane said, standing in front of the fireplace and blocking Ron's view of the logs.
"We'll do whatever helps your guys."
He threw a few slivers of wood on top of the glowing logs, causing a stream of embers to puff from the orange glow. The logs caught immediately and rejuvenated the flames. Rory had a clear view into the fireplace and watched as Lane put the tip of the poker to the remnant of her cherry red boot and pushed it into the flames. It caught and melted away to nothing. Lane threw another log on the fire and hung the poker with the other fireplace tools. Rory watched as Lane slid the throw rug, which lay on the hard wood in front of the hearth, to his left until it covered the smear of crimson.
"Needless to say," Ron continued, "we've got a goddamn mess on our hands. The media are going to have a field day with this. Being that he was your client, the state guys are going to want to talk with you too, Rory. I'm heading there now, if you want to tag along."
Rory suddenly wanted Ron Davidson out of her house, and the last place on earth she wanted to go was back to that cabin. "Yeah," she said, nodding her head. "Probably be a good idea." Lane had sat back down in the chair across from her. He too was nodding. They made eye contact, staring at each other with volumes of wordless conversation happening between them.
"Probably a good idea," Lane repeated.
"Give me a minute," Rory asked.
"Of course,"
Ron said. He stood from the couch.
"I'll call and let my guys know we're on the way."
Ron walked to the front door, his phone already to his ear. Rory continued to look at Lane after Ron was gone. She wanted to talk with him, to tell him everything.
"You better get dressed," Lane said.
10 minutes later, Rory found Ron on the front porch. He held up a finger as he finished his call. When he slipped his phone into his breast pocket a minute later, he did so with a quizzical look.
"You ready?"
he asked. "Yeah," Rory said, adjusting her glasses. "What's the matter?" Ron looked down at her feet.
"I've never seen you without your boots on."
Rory pulled her beanie cap down on her head. She'd found a spare in her closet. She had a replacement for her coat, too, which was now buttoned up to her neck. But she had owned only one pair of boots. 10 years old, perfectly formed to her feet, and now melted to a pile of ash. "Well," she said, "it's a mess out there. I don't want to ruin them." She walked past her boss and climbed into the front seat of his unmarked cruiser. Chapter 47. Peoria, Illinois, December 5th, 2019. Two items rested on the passenger seat waiting for delivery. Rory pulled to a stop in the parking lot of the Harold Washington Library Center. She picked up one of the items, Camille Bird's Kestner doll, and carried it into the lobby. She spotted Walter Bird standing in nearly the exact spot where she had met him weeks before. When she approached, his stare was set firmly on the box in her hands. Rory adjusted her glasses. "Sorry it took me so long to get this back to you."
"Is it finished?" Mr. Bird asked.
Rory pointed to the doors of the library. "I'll show you how it turned out. I think you're going to be pleased with it." They walked into the library and found an empty table in the back corner. Rory placed the box on the surface and opened the top. She carefully removed Camille's doll and handed it to him. Walter Bird took the doll in his hands, swallowed hard and ran his hand over the surface of its face. Rory saw the man's eyes glaze over with tears. He looked up at her. "Thank you," he said. "It's truly remarkable." Rory averted her eyes and nodded. "I wanted to let you know," she said, "that Camille's case is all I will be working on now. I've got one more thing to take care of, and then all my attention will be on your daughter." Mr. Bird looked up from the doll. "Thank you," he said again. Rory wanted to tell the man that his daughter had helped her in ways that were unimaginable. They were unexplainable as well, and no one would understand how the soul of a dead girl who waited for Rory's help had pushed her to the precipice of her epiphany. So instead, she said, "I feel a connection to Camille and a need to help her. I promise I will." She turned and walked out of the library, leaving Camille Bird's father holding the now flawless restoration of his child's doll. Outside, she headed to her car to deliver the second item that waited on her front seat. She drove the long, straight country road as the barren cornfields blurred past in her peripheral vision. It was late afternoon and the sun was approaching the horizon, sitting out in front of her on the flat landscape. The sky was cloudless, melting from cotton blue to a deep shade of salmon as the day fell away. The body of every woman who went missing in 1979 had been located behind the cabin in Starved Rock. The identities had been made via dental records, and the victims' families had finally found closure. Sadly, many of the women's family members had passed before the discovery. Most of the parents had died without knowing for certain the fate of their daughters. But their siblings were living, and many were present at the press conference when Detective Davidson explained the discovery to the world. The news media covered the story at a frantic pace. Thomas Mitchell, the events of the summer of 1979, and the tragic discovery at the cabin in Starved Rock 40 years later would forever be folklore for true crime junkies. It was sure to be revisited at some point when a filmmaker decided to create a documentary about the case. When that happened, Rory wanted no one knocking on her door and asking questions. She wanted only to be a small footnote in the Thomas Mitchell saga, the attorney who briefly represented him during his parole. She didn't even want that mentioned, but she knew there was no way around it. What she desperately sought was to hide the truth. The truth about Angela Mitchell, her escape to Greta's farmhouse, and the child she bore before she died. A child whose blood ran thick with Thomas Mitchell's DNA. "For Christ's sake," Rory thought. "What a field day the nuts on the internet would have with all that." It was no wonder the people who loved her most took such extraordinary measures to bury the secrets of the past. Rory planned to do all she could to keep them underground. She knew it would take effort. People would continue to dig. There was a buzzing conversation, mostly relegated to chat rooms and Reddit threads, about one victim whose body had not been found buried at Thomas Mitchell's cabin, that of his wife Angela, the woman who had started her own investigation in 1979 and had become the nucleus of the thief's downfall. One phase of the public's conversation fed into the deep sympathy that since Angela's remains had not been unearthed, and now that Thomas Mitchell was gone, the whereabouts of her body would forever stay a mystery. The other dialogue was conspiratorial, with theorists suggesting that there was a simple explanation for why her body was not found at the Starved Rock cabin. Angela Mitchell was still alive. Conspiracy theories always trumped sympathy, and over the past month this discourse became louder and louder until it dominated the conversation. True crime buffs jumped on the bandwagon to claim that Angela Mitchell was out there somewhere. They promised to keep searching for her. As Rory drove the lonely country road, though, she knew the truth. She finally understood it all. Not only had she reconstructed Angela's death, but she had pieced together her own childhood. The missing fragments came together in a way that both shocked and settled Rory's soul. It was a reconstruction that had taken a lifetime to assemble. Careful deliberation and months of searching told her she was the only one left who knew the truth, and she had no intention of sharing her knowledge with the world. She had briefly considered confiding in Ron Davidson, telling him everything. She should have, probably, but the repercussions were too unpredictable. If she confessed to Ron, she feared smart people would start asking questions, and if put onto a scent, investigators would start sniffing. If one of them began to dig the way Rory had dug, she worried they'd find the same lineage she unearthed. It was a secret Rory planned to carry to her grave. The only people who knew the truth were gone, and she was satisfied that wherever they were now, somewhere off in the by and by, they were watching her as she made this final journey. They were proud of her. A deep sense of peace came to her as she drove. It was a reconciliation never before experienced that allowed her to feel free and alive, liberated somehow. She had made her choice, and she was comfortable with it. The long road came to a T, where Rory turned left. A moment later, the farmhouse appeared before her. She hadn't been here in some time. Aunt Greta had moved to the nursing home several years before, and until today, Rory never had reason to return. As soon as she saw the old farmhouse, though, with its blue painted cedar and wraparound porch, she realized how much she missed it. Her memories transported her to the summers she spent there as a child. With her mind flooded by flashbacks, Rory turned up the gravel driveway. She parked at the front, where the gravel ended and the never-ending expanse of grass began. A moment passed as she waited for anyone to appear from inside. She wasn't sure how she would proceed if the new owners were home. But what she needed to do could not wait. The pull in her chest was too strong to ignore. After a few minutes, the farmhouse stayed still and quiet in the fading light of dusk, silhouetted by the lavender horizon. Rory looked at herself in the rearview mirror. Even during the long ride out to the country, she kept her thick plastic glasses on her face and the beanie cap slung low on her forehead. She reached up and pulled them off. Today, of all times, she couldn't hide. Didn't want to hide. Didn't need to. She dropped her hat and glasses on the passenger seat and picked up the other item that had made the trip with her. She opened the door and climbed out into the evening. She walked to the side of the farmhouse and into the backyard. The rear porch was to her left, and she remembered in vivid detail the night when she was 10 years old, when the buzzing in her chest had pulled her out of bed and into this field during the middle of the night. She remembered the smoky glow of the moon and the far-off thunderstorm that ignited the horizon with intermittent pulses of lightning. Tonight, the fading sun burned lilac on the horizon, the sky above a dark cobalt. Rory found the low, two-tiered stable fence that ran the length of the property. She followed it again now, the same way she had the night the amazing calm had come over her. Nearly 30 years later, and Rory finally understood the meaning of that night, the lure in her chest, the magnetism that had pulled her, and the sense of peace that had washed over her when she had lifted that rose and had inhaled the sweetness of its scent. Rory followed the fence to the back edge of the property, where it turned at a 90-degree angle and ran off to her left. Once she arrived at the corner of the prairie, Rory looked down at the ground. The only other time in her life when she stood in this spot, she had found the flowers she always watched Aunt Greta pick from the garden, the ones she helped bundle. The conspiracy theorists could have their chat rooms and threads. They could keep their wild and uneducated ideas about Angela Mitchell and where she was today. None would ever know the truth. None would ever find her. Angela hadn't wanted to be found 40 years ago, and she didn't want to be found today. Rory lifted the item she had carried with her from the car. A bouquet of roses tied in a tight bundle. She placed them to her nose, closed her eyes, and took in their sweet scent. Then she crouched down and laid them on the ground. The End. This is Nina Alvemar. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Some Choose Darkness by Charlie Donnelly. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Google Play, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.